for the slight delay, but there were some traffic issues, but we're all here now.
For Justice Birdwell, so.
I was going to keep it, you know,
No, that's fine. I'll own it. Thank you, though.
Anyway, so I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We have one case on the oral argument docket, as you've probably figured out. Let me introduce the panel quickly before we get started. To my left is visiting Justice Ruben Gonzalez.
Morning.
To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. I'm Elizabeth Kerr. And I understand that everybody's checked in with the deputy clerk. So if everyone's ready, we'll call the case and get started.
The court will now call Anthony Lopez versus TV and Nightlife. May it please the court, Mr. Brian Bushes to argue for the appellate, Mr. Jacob Buchanan to argue for the appellate.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. I'm Brian Butcher. I represent Anthony Lopez, and I think the causes of action in this lawsuit can be taxonomized under three broad headings, which would be dram shop violation and negligence violations against the bar and also intentional tort of assault. I'll start with the dram shop violations because I think preeminently this is a dram shop case. It's a textbook in a lot of ways, and I also think it's the easiest argument that I have. And what I would like to say first is that it is not illegal for somebody to get drunk at a bar. It is, however, illegal for a bar to serve somebody after they are visibly intoxicated to the point that it's apparent that they're a danger to themselves or others.
Do we know from the evidence whether the bar was serving Mr. Lopez directly or whether his friends were buying drinks at the bar and taking them to him? What's the evidence on that?
It was both, Your Honor, and there are two affidavits that are attached in the summary judgment record. One is from Anthony Lopez himself, and another is from his friend. The friend responsibly became the designated driver after he saw Anthony Lopez getting snookered. So he stopped drinking himself, remained there. And the evidence before the trial court was that Mr. Lopez continued to be served with numerous shots. I think he had 6 or 7 shots on top of 10 beers over a course of just a few hours. At the bar, the friend was going to take care of him, take him home. While he was being served, people were laughing and talking about how drunk he was. There was comments by the server along the lines of, your friend doesn't look so good. And nonetheless, he continued to be served. So under the Dram Shop Act, first prong 2.02b1, we have to show that there's evidence, more than a scintilla of evidence, to support the claim of over-service in violation of the Dram Shop Law. That part is easy in this case because this person didn't get just a little drunk. He wasn't just visibly intoxicated. He was so drunk at the end of this night that he could barely stand. He could barely walk. When he's being escorted out of the bar, he's having trouble walking. And I think the question that I would like for the justices to keep in their mind is this one. Exactly how intoxicated, how egregious must the violations of the Dram Shop Act be in order for a person to get so drunk that he has only evanescent, hazy, spotty recollection of the entire night's events, but he doesn't even remember how his eyeball was punctured? Those are the damages.
Let's go back to your first question.
Okay.
You have to be obviously intoxicated.
Yes.
Okay. Would you agree with me that there are different levels of intoxication?
Certainly.
Okay. And that those different levels of intoxication can be obvious in different ways. You can be staggeringly drunk. You can be foolishly drunk. You can be unconsciously drunk, incapacitated completely. The statute doesn't actually qualify the word intoxicated other than with the word obviously. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you have to be, and the obviousness is qualified. So you could be various degrees of intoxicated under the statute for liability to kick in.
That is true.
Okay. And so, but there's also another qualification, and that is that you have to be the provider or the server has to determine from that obvious intoxication that the patron is a danger to himself or to others. So that qualifies intoxicated as well.
Yes.
Okay. And so you've got the safe harbor provision, which presumably the TABC is telling everybody what level of intoxication and what it means, what you should be observing if somebody is in fact a danger to himself or to others.
That is correct.
Okay. So here, quite literally, the only duty is to not serve someone if they are intoxicated to the point that they are a danger to themselves or to others.
Yes.
You can serve them all the way up to the point where they become dangerous, and there's no liability. Would you agree with me?
Yes, up to the point that you cannot serve somebody after they are obviously intoxicated. When somebody is obviously intoxicated, they become a danger to themselves. And I think it's important that the statute says to himself or others. Now, it's not just others, it's to himself.
Well, Sewell v. Smith makes it very clear that that language contemplates liability with regard to the injury to the patron. That's the language it focuses on, because that contemplates a duty to the patron to protect the patron from his own intoxication, okay?
Right.
But it's when does that duty kick in? And under the statute, the duty doesn't kick in until the provider determines that they are observably intoxicated in some way, shape, or form, and the provider makes a determination, completely subjective, that they're a danger to themselves or to others.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does it require them to do an alcohol test on them, a breathalyzer test, or anything like that to say, okay, you take the breathalyzer before I serve you again? It's all purely subjective observation on the part of the provider. Is that correct?
Nothing to disagree with there. And what I would add, I guess, if I could, is that the...
Well, I'm asking, go ahead and add, and then I'll tell you where I'm going.
Well, the case law, I believe, renders some of that statutory language superfluous, because after somebody is obviously intoxicated, they are automatically a danger to themselves or others. And that's why, once there is signs...
The statute doesn't actually say that, though. That's qualified. It contemplates you can be intoxicated without being a danger to yourself or others.
To the extent that they are a danger to themselves or others is okay. What the statute says, but yes.
The reason I'm going there is that because this is an exclusive cause of action which preempts the common law with regard to any kind of liability, it wipes out El Chico in terms of the common law, all right? What is the duty of a provider? Is it just simply to quit serving somebody and then let them wander off the premises? Are they responsible for making sure they don't trip over themselves and hurt themselves on the premises, even though they've quit serving them? In this instance, because the evidence that there is evidence that in fact security told him he had to leave, and he was expelled from the bar, but he wasn't actually expelled from the premises. He was just taken out into the parking lot, okay? Is that part of the liability that's contemplated by the Dram Shop Act, or have they simply met their duty by not serving anything?
Thank you, Justice Berger. Well, I came here to fight about the interpretation of the exclusive remedy provision, and I think that the dram shop language is very clear that it relates to the provision of alcohol, getting somebody drunk, serving them after they are showing visible signs of intoxication, but it does not relieve the bar. I understand what El Chico says, but it does not relieve the bar of any other liability they may have for other negligence. You can get somebody drunk, and that would be a violation of the Dram Shop Act, but it doesn't say that the bar can then do anything that they want to anybody who's intoxicated at the bar. They can't give them the keys, they can't push them out into the street, they can't put somebody in a dangerous position. I have, in my negligence allegations in this case, alleged that there's negligence with regard to placing Anthony Lopez in a dangerous position. Effectively, they cut him off from his friends who were there to help him and had already made a decision that they weren't going to drink and be the designated driver. And the friend goes to the bathroom. He gets kicked out. He's telling them, my friend's in the bathroom. They say, too bad. There's evidence in the record that another friend was trying to go to him to help while this was happening, and the bouncer said, no, you stay there. He's leaving. So he is cut off, and he's put in the most dangerous position at the premises.
The record actually reflects that he's removed and his friend is prevented from caring for him, taking him out of the bar.
That's correct. That's exactly what happens. And so I would say that's not negligence related to the provision selling of alcohol, which is what the dram shop contemplates. And the transmogrification, the dilation of what they want the exclusive remedy to be is that it cuts off any other form of liability, including assault. That's what their argument is. And so in other words, if you do exactly what they say, then the bar could get somebody drunk and do anything. They could fondle them, rape them, rob them, run them over with a car, and that's not what the legislature intended, obviously.
Well, I'm going to be unfair here for just a minute, okay? There's a case that y'all are going to need to look at. It's called Ventitulius versus O'Brien. It's out of Houston, the 14th in 1995. It was dismissed by agreement, the PET was, where it dealt with a situation where there was an assumption of a duty, okay, where the owner of the bar prompted the young lady to stay in the bar and drink by saying, well, give me your keys and I'll make sure you get home. And they drank for quite some time. Then he took her out to her car, apparently made a pass. She didn't accept it. So he put her in her car, put the keys in the ignition, closed the door and walked away. And at some point in time later on, she's in an accident and injures herself, okay? And the court in that instance found that there was an assumption of the duty on the part of the bar because he had promised that he would take care of her. So there was an assumption of taking care, okay? There's a Fifth Circuit case that I don't have down here, but on the flip side of that, gentleman becomes too drunk, bar calls the police come and get him, and then instead of taking him to the hospital to be cared for, taking him home where he can sleep it off, or taking him to the police station for public intoxication, these individuals, these law enforcement officers, decide we're going to drop him off and at a highway, off the just on the highway, and he gets run over. So he sues the bar, but the bar is considered to be free by the Fifth Circuit because it was not foreseeable that the police would just leave him out in the middle of nowhere where he wouldn't be able to take care of himself. So the bar is actually not liable. Those two cases aren't discussed in any of the briefing here. And there's one final case where I'm talking about this degree of intoxication, and it goes more to your defense about there's nothing to tell us what happened, but it also does talk about the degree of intoxication. It's a case called Paris versus Greater Northern Railroad Company versus Robinson. It's from 1911. Where a gentleman gets on the train, and it involves a common carrier, so I don't know whether the common carrier duty would be related to the dram shop duty here, okay? But the three things it points out, the guy gets on the train, he's intoxicated, and then he ends up leaving, going out on the platform and falling off the platform in some way, shape, or form. They talk about the degree of intoxication, what would be the observable aspects of the intoxication, and whether the key was whether or not the common carrier, the employees, knew he was intoxicated, all right? But they clearly state that if they knew he was intoxicated to the point that he was mentally incapacitated, because they were a common carrier, they would have to make sure he was safe. They would have to effectively ensure his safety, all right? So, but there's no evidence that he was mentally incapacitated. He was merely intoxicated, all right? And so they end up finding that there was no liability, but in large part they also do it on causation because they said, we don't know how he left the train. We don't know whether he went out a window, et cetera. But the distinction may in fact be that they're allowed to make that causation issue because in fact he wasn't unconsciously drunk. He wasn't helplessly drunk, all right? So those three cases, with the bench's permission here, y'all need to send us a little bit about that afterwards. That case is called Paris. The other one is the Ventitulius. And
the other is Kovacic versus Larry Brown. And I believe that is part of the briefing here.
I don't remember that one.
I know
being
the case.
Part of the briefing, but you may know the briefing, yeah.
And I don't want to disagree with you, but if you'll allow me to disagree with you.
Well, what do you make of any and all of that? And your time's almost up.
I tell you what.
I have filibustered, and
yes,
she didn't hit me with the shock collar.
We're here to hear from the lawyers as well as asking penetrating questions, and so I'm going to ask the clerk to add 5 minutes to your time, Mr. Butcher, and Appley can have an extra 5 minutes if they wish to avail themselves of it.
Thank you. I think the Kovacic case is very important to our argument because it illustrates exactly what we're saying. When you said that it said the bar is not liable, respectfully, I don't think it says that exactly. It says that for the provision of alcohol, the dram shop cause of action, there is no liability for the bar because there is a new and independent or superseding cause, and that's the negligence of the officers who come and pick up the person. The bar has every reasonable expectation that they would take him to the drunk tank or take him home or, you know, something, instead of leaving him out in the middle of a highway where he's wandering around drunk and gets hit by a car. So that I would agree. That makes perfect sense that that's a superseding cause. It happens miles off the campus after he's in the custody of somebody that you would think is going to do the right thing. But the Kovacic case goes on to say that the causes of action that don't relate to the service of alcohol, which included, I believe it was false imprisonment, because his friends were there and they wanted to take him home before the police arrived, and they said no, they wouldn't let him leave. They waited till the police got there. So there was a claim for false imprisonment. In the Kovacic case, the Fifth Circuit says very clearly that those causes of actions still go on. So those aren't barred by the exclusive remedy provision, and I don't think any of the unrelated causes of action we have, negligent, unreasonable use of force or putting him in a dangerous position, cutting him off from his friends, those are unrelated. So I would say that's good authority for exactly what we want to say. As far as the case in Houston, Your Honor, I think if I'm hearing that correctly, they, in addition to over-serving, they put the person, it's analogous, if not exactly, a negligent undertaking, which is different than the provision of alcohol. So I would argue, and I'll be happy to brief, the Ventitulius case and the Paris case and the Kovacic case a little bit more. But I think those are...
I guess what I'm trying to get to is, to what does the dram shop duty, is the duty simply to stop serving and then let things, in other words, I can serve you until you're obviously intoxicated and a danger to yourself and avoid liability as long as I stop serving you. And that means you could walk out, get in a car, go kill a family on the highway, but as long as I didn't serve you after you were obviously intoxicated and a danger to yourself, I have no liability, even though every bit of alcohol in your system you obtained in my tavern.
Yes, and I think that would, if you stop serving when the person, before they become visibly intoxicated, that bars the dram shop cause of action. But let's just say, I'll invite you to a thought exercise. Let's just say somebody consumes a liter of vodka before they ever get there. Or let's just say they go into the bathroom and nobody's serving them or providing them at the bar. They go into the bathroom, they pull out their whiskey bottle, and they get drunk in the bathroom. Does that then mean that the bar can do any array of negligent things to that person? And I would say that there's an entire body of common law under the broad heading of negligence that says, no, they cannot. They can be liable even if they didn't provide the alcohol. So in this case, of course, they provided the alcohol. There's no doubt about that, and I think there's clear evidence in the affidavits that they were serving alcohol after Mr. Lopez was visibly intoxicated. They kept serving him after his keys were taken, after everybody was laughing at him and buying him shots. So there's clear evidence of violation of the first prong of the dram shop. And I think this, at least the trial court, was exclusively an issue of causation, whether or not there can be proximate causation when the person becomes so drunk, if the violations are so egregious that they black out and don't remember something as awful as puncturing an eyeball.
So does the removal of a drunk patron from the premises, is that a common law remedy that has not been excluded by the Dram Shop Act, because that is effectively something that's happening after the key aspect of the duty to not serve occurs?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that the Dram Shop Act never eclipsed the common law duties of negligence for anything involving.
And with that being the case, then where in your pleadings did your pleadings broad enough for us to interpret as anything other than an assault? As opposed to a trip and fall out in the parking lot.
You can answer that question, Mr. Butcher.
And then I'll
be
quiet.
We need to move on.
Thank you. 5.03 of my petition, and I can tell you the citation in the record, but it's early in the record. I think it's the first thing in the clerk's record, and it's under paragraph 5.03, and it lists broad things, including a catch-all provision about other acts of negligence, but it specifically mentions negligent unreasonable use of force, as well as failure to follow policies, placing Mr. Lopez in a dangerous position. You can read it, but I think I'm summarizing it fairly.
So. Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I find it striking that Mr. Butcher describes this as preeminently a dram shop case when the first factual allegation.
He may have had some help with regard to that, but.
the first factual allegation, and in fact, the only factual allegation, the entire factual underpinning, is that the lawsuit arises out of the brutal assault of Lopez by a CBE employee. That is the first factual allegation. And, you know, we've argued to this court that any alternative factual theory is waived. But in any event, even assuming that there is a dram shop claim not predicated on an assault and the assault claim, both of those fail for primarily the reason of causation. Now, as for the assault claim, you know, we didn't hear much discussion of it, but essentially, as we've argued in our briefing, Lopez has waived error on this. We move for no evidence summary judgment on this ground. The trial court issued a general summary judgment order. They have the burden to challenge all grounds supporting the judgment. There is no discussion of course and scope here. So that alone is a reason to affirm the assault claim. Now, also more fundamentally, there's no evidence.
Did you specifically move for no evidence on course and scope?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. We specifically moved for no evidence on course and scope. Now, just a general summary judgment order.
Move for no evidence with regard to premises?
To premises, what do you mean, Your Honor?
In other words, he...
We move for summary judgment on preemption and said any remaining common law theories are preempted. And, you know...
Okay, so what evidence did you put in the record with regard to the ability of the off-duty officers to just decide who was going to be kicked out of the bar?
Well, respectfully, that's not our burden.
Does the manager not control
the determination
of who gets to stay in the bar and who gets to leave the bar?
Mr. Evans's affidavit makes clear that we do not hire bouncers. These are not security guards.
But somebody is making a decision as to whether or not a patron is expelled from the tavern. Who makes that decision? Is the evidence in the record with regard to these off-duty police officers, that they can independently, as independent contractors, make a decision about who will and will not remain a patron at the bar? Or does the decision about who gets removed and who does not get made by the management?
Mr. Evans's affidavit suggests that this is left to the discretion of the off-duty police officer.
They just wander around the bar and they just take people out at random without any reference to management whatsoever, they've paid for their liquor or not.
These are trained Fort Worth police officers.
Understand that, but the decision as to whether or not they're going to be removed, who makes that decision?
I believe ultimately that would be within the discretion of the
officer. No consultation from the management as to whether or not have they paid, what's their bar tab, anything of that nature.
Your Honor, at this point in the summary judgment record, the answer to that is not entirely clear. But I want to say regardless, those common law claims regarding removing him, regarding just leaving him out there, those are preempted because the case law is very clear on this. They arise out of the alleged overservice of alcohol. Section 2.03 is a very broadly applied preemption provision, and it says clearly, the liability of providers under this chapter for the actions of their employees, customers, members, or guests who are or become intoxicated is in lieu of common law or other statutory law, warranties, and duties of providers of alcoholic beverages. Section 2.03 makes it even clearer. It codifies the exclusive action against an alcohol provider for injuries or damages resulting from the intoxication.
So your position is that these guys, these officers, can basically walk up and pull Ron White and said, you're out of here, and fling him out of the bar, go outside, beat the snot out of him, as long as the bar has not overserved by serving that individual when he was obviously intoxicated and a danger to himself or others?
Certainly not, Your Honor. There would be other duties there.
That's what I'm trying to find out here, counsel, is where does the exclusivity end and the common law pick back up?
When you allege that the intoxication was the proximate cause of your injury. Let's look to the case law on this. Yarborough versus McCormick, a gross negligence claim arising out of the alleged overservice where there was a car accident, based on overservice. That was preempted. Bolanos versus Purple Goat, you had a third party there who assaulted an employee, both of whom had been drinking while the employee was on the job. And the plaintiff there sued the bar for failing to provide adequate security to patrons. The court looked at it as in the...
Which case is that, counsel?
This is Bolanos versus Purple Goat out of the El Paso Court of Appeals. And the court looked
Gotta love the name. Okay.
Purple Goat. The substance arose out of the intoxication. In fact, the court made this remark. The opening line from the argument section of Bolanos' appellate brief concedes that appellant's tort claims arose out of the Purple Goat's over-serving alcohol. This pegs this claim as one governed by the Dram Shop Act, and thus it was preempted. Parker, similar situation, and even...
So keeping patrons secure is covered by the Dram Shop Act.
If the allegation essentially arises from his alleged over-service. Here, we clearly meet that. How do we know? Let's look to how Mr. Butcher described it in his brief to this court. The first sentence of the conclusion. This case arises from violations of the Texas Dram Shop Act that are extraordinary in scope. The supplemental summary judgment briefing. This to me makes it clear as day. He says, in this case, a jury could draw a reasonable inference based on the temporal and geographic proximity to plaintiff's rough ejection by the bar security personnel that he was negligently or intentionally injured by the bouncers. The jury could likewise draw a reasonable inference that the plaintiff was injured as a result of falling down. Both of these inferences are premised upon the plaintiff's extreme intoxication. I mean, it's really that simple. They allege it arises out of the overservice, thus it's preempted. And I want to just add, too.
What if he is intoxicated to the point of mental and physical incapacity? And that's anticipating you're going to go read Paris and go, what the heck is he talking about? But the McHugh, which is cited in El Chico and is, I think, subsequently cited in Sewell, says that the two guys who say, hey, we'll make sure that I will bet you can't drink 3 pints of whiskey, and at 2 pints of whiskey, he's so intoxicated that he's incapable of making a decision one way or the other. He drinks the third and he dies from alcohol poisoning. And that's a wrongful death cause of action that the Supreme Court permitted in the 19th century. And that's cited in El Chico. And it's cited, and so the bottom line is there's a point in time where the case law in Texas says that somebody can become so intoxicated that they are unconscious, they are essentially helpless. So if he's helpless, do you not assume a duty to protect him at that point in time?
In 2000, I believe it was 1987, which was after the case you're describing, the Texas legislature said this is going to be public policy. The Dram Shop Act codifies the exclusive cause of action. So anything else related to that overservice would be preempted. And I would just like to add, too, that even if it weren't, there's still the same fundamental causation problem that transcends all of the claims here. There's simply no evidence that, say, he was assaulted by a CBE employee outside. There's also no evidence that his intoxication proximately caused the injury. We just don't know what happened.
Well, if you walked a child out into the parking lot and left him, even if you didn't assault him, you just walked him out there and said, you can't come in anymore, you just stay out here in the parking lot, and they get run over. And that's someone, or a mentally incompetent individual. You wheel them out in their wheelchair and stick them out in the parking lot, whether you assault them or not.
Sure.
There's somebody who is mentally incompetent. So is there in fact some type of common law duty?
Maybe there, and in that
from
scenario,
a premises owner standpoint.
In that scenario, you are not suing the provider as a provider of alcohol. The Love case from the Texas Supreme Court discusses this. Tangentially, sort of, and it says, you know, generally the Dram Shop Act, you cannot bring common law claims arising out of overservice. There, they carved out a very narrow exception in which an employee who was an exotic dancer essentially was encouraged to drink on the job by the employer, and then she went and got in an accident. And the court said, no, in this scenario, you're not suing the bar as a provider of alcohol, you're suing them as an employer who failed to create a safe condition.
Well,
a
that kind
of
gets to Otis Engineering a little bit. It gets close to Otis Engineering. So
it does, Your Honor. But I mean, just to sort of take a step back of this, I want to emphasize that Lopez has no recollection of what happened. He told the police officer he can't remember what happened, and he has no idea who could have done this to him. He told his doctor the same thing, but he's representing to the trial court and this court that he was brutally assaulted by an off-duty Fort Worth police officer.
Let me ask you this. Counsel represented that, in fact, when he was removed from the I thought in reading the briefs that the friend was in the bathroom when he was removed, but counsel's represented that the friend actually wanted to try and help his friend leave the bar and was prevented from doing so. So do you agree with that representation, or?
I don't believe so. There was one friend who was in the bathroom. We don't know how long he was in the bathroom, but I think that's an important fact here. He came out and his friend had been removed. And what Carrillo says in his affidavit is that my friends told me that he was then removed from the bar. Now, we had a hearsay objection to that, and that was sustained. So what do we have? We have his inability to remember. We have this unidentified temporal gap between when he was removed and when he was found. No witnesses, no scientific evidence.
Do we have any indication whether he was found near his vehicle or was he somewhere wandered off someplace else?
That's a good question, Your Honor. Carrillo, when he came out of the bar, he said, we did not see him immediately, suggesting he was not right by the door. We had to go look for him, and we found him in the parking lot. So, I mean, this court has
is there any affidavit evidence from the security people themselves as to what they did?
No, Your Honor. I believe we stated in a discovery response that the Fort Worth police officers had no recollection of this incident. You know, they said they regularly have to eject patrons
sure.
from the bar, and
there was also no video evidence that would determine.
We didn't have any video evidence. I believe the investigating officer went to neighboring businesses to look and see if they had anything helpful. He concluded no, said there was no evidence to determine what happened, and thus they closed the investigation. So this really gets to a principle of logic and law called the equal inference rule. And so based on these circumstances, the court has to answer, whether a reasonable and fair-minded jury found or could find that he was assaulted by a CBE employee.
Well, in the case that I cited to you, the Paris case talks about the equal inference. They talk specifically, we don't know whether he jumped out the window, what
right.
he did, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's exactly.
But my question, and this is what I'm looking for with regard to the supplemental briefing, would be, does the fact that a patron becomes intoxicated to the point of mental incapacity change that dynamic? Okay, because there's no issue about he was removed from the bar. Okay, there's no fact issue that he was removed from the bar. The issue is the manner in which he was removed from the bar. The issue is to what extent he was intoxicated at the time he was removed from the bar.
Sure.
And so with regard to those fact issues, is there an assumption of a duty if a provider removes somebody from the bar who is mentally incapable of protecting themselves? Do they assume a duty in that removal of making sure that that removal is done in a safe and reasonable manner?
Without having read that case,
sure.
My answer would be likely the legislature abrogated any other duties when it passed the Dram Shop Act, and the plain text of that legislation, it imposes a duty not to overserve, not to care for, not to do everything else after overservice, like you mentioned. And you know, thinking about it from a policy standpoint, this would be extremely burdensome on bars if they had to, you know, if I may say, babysit all of their patrons. The duty is not to overserve, and it does not extend to things beyond that. But if I may, I'd like to just go back briefly to the equal inference rule. An inference of assault or an inference that his intoxication caused the injury are not reasonable here because other possibilities are just as likely. He could have been assaulted by a stranger. Someone could have accidentally bumped into him and knocked him over. He could have been hit by a rock that was kicked up from a passing car. The point is, we just don't know, and there's no reason to think that anyone is more probable than another. And that's what City of Texas City, that's what Hancock versus Varium, all of these equal inference rule cases require a probability. You can't just have multiple inferences and say, well, any of these might be reasonable, so therefore we can impose liability here. One has to be more probable than another. In fact, City of Texas City expressly stated that an inference is not reasonable if it is susceptible to multiple equally probable inferences, none of which are more likely than another.
Is it not a reasonable inference that if a helplessly drunk individual is forcibly removed into the parking lot, not even off premises, that their helplessness can render them capable of being injured, either by themselves because they're mentally incapacitated, or by others?
I think that's a possible inference, and it might even be plausible. But it's not probable, and that's what the case law requires. And to be probable, you have to have a logical bridge between the injury and the intoxication, or here, the assault. I mean, don't take my word for it. Let's look at how he described it in the summary judgment hearing. You know, there's a sort of belated pivot to this alternative factual scenario in which, even if he wasn't assaulted, he may have been injured through some other means. And in fact, his briefing to this court, pages 13 to 14 and 22, recognizes there are other possibilities, which renders the assault inference unreasonable. And in the summary judgment hearing, if he was put in a dangerous position, stumbling around a parking lot where there are tripping hazards, there are other drunk customers, there are cars, if he is put in that position by the bar, yeah, they have some responsibility. But the problem is there's a fundamental gap in proof where we do not know what happened. It's not his inability to remember that dooms his claim. It's the complete and total absence of any other evidence indicating what happened to him out there. Truly, the possibilities are endless. And under the Dram Shop claim, to the extent there is this alternative factual scenario, we think it may have been waived, but even assuming it's not, he has to show that the intoxication caused his injuries. Here we're just focusing on essentially but-for causation. But for his intoxication, would he have been injured? And the answer is, we don't know, because we don't know how he was injured. And if we don't know the circumstances concerning what happened to him out there, a jury cannot reasonably infer that he was injured because of his intoxication. It cannot say why. And a lot of the Texas Supreme Court cases applying the equal inference rule support its application here. For example, Marathon Court, that was a personal injury case in which an AC repairman suffered traumatic head injuries, and he could not recall what happened. There was evidence that was consistent with him falling off the roof because of a premises condition.
Is this the one about the electrocution, whether he
yes.
fell off the roof
yes.
as opposed to getting popped off the roof by
That's
being
right.
electrocuted?
Or
right.
assaulted. And the court said, well, wait a minute. A jury would necessarily have to speculate as to what happened. It's the same here. Suspicion linked to suspicion breeds only more suspicion. And that does not substitute for evidence of what happened. One more case, Hancock versus Varium, Texas Supreme Court 2013. It was a defamation case in which a physician at a medical school sent a defamatory letter complaining of the plaintiff. And the defendant sent that letter to the plaintiff medical school's accrediting entity, which then denied accreditation. And the plaintiff used that denial as evidence of reputational harm. And Justice Guzman said, wait a minute, there's no evidence that accreditation was denied because of the letter. There are multiple reasons why this could have happened. There's no reason for thinking one is any more probable than another. Again, there are just endless possibilities. And there's another analytical lens that I think is helpful to analyze this case under, and that is what the plaintiff is really trying to do is invoke a res ipsa loquitur theory to fill their proof void. What they're essentially saying is, you know, the very fact that he was injured under these circumstances supports an inference of causation. But the problem is, under res ipsa, you have to show that the nature of the injury, here an eye injury, it has to be one that would not ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence. In other words, here, the eye injury, could it have occurred for reasons unrelated to his alleged overservice? And the answer is absolutely. There's, again, endless possibilities. He could have been in a fight. He could have been accidentally knocked over. And a lot of those are not logically tied to his intoxication. We just don't know.
Paris actually, in discussing the jumping out of the window, talks about res ipsa. So I think y'all are going to find that informative.
All right. And if I may.
You can wrap up briefly. Did you get your extra 5 minutes? I didn't pay attention to the clock.
That was only 20 minutes, Your Honor.
Sorry?
That was only 20 minutes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But, you know,
if you would like a few
more minutes.
I'll
just wrap up briefly by saying.
I've just caused so much trouble today. Sorry.
That I want to be candid and say that if there was evidence of what happened to him outside, it might be a different situation. Then we have a different case. For example, if there's a witness who said, yes, I saw him stumbling around out there and then he fell over, that might be different. But the problem is there's just nothing in the record, truly.
Do we have any type of temporal evidence like we might have with the Kroger case with the how long the grape's been on the floor? In other words, from the time that his friend comes out of the bathroom to the time they actually go out and find him, do we have any type of temporal evidence with regard to that time frame such that, hey, we were out there, you know, as soon as he was taken out, we went out looking for him?
Now, he's going to argue that it happened within minutes, but all the evidence shows is that Carrillo was in the bathroom for an undetermined amount of time. We don't know how long, and when he came out, then he was told that his friend had been removed, and he went looking for him. So, you know, was it 2 hours, 3 hours? Maybe, probably not. But really, there's no indication of how long he was in the restroom. But that temporal gap, I mean, the length of that gap isn't really what's important. What's more important, I think, is just the very existence of this sort of fracture in the logical bridge regarding what happened to him out there. I mean, again, they recognize multiple possibilities. None of them are more probable than any other. That's what the law requires. Thus, it is necessarily speculative. There's no sufficient basis on which a jury could find against us on liability. So unless the court has any other questions, I'll see the remainder of
Thank
my time
you.
And ask you to affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Butcher.
think it was Churchill drawing on his experience in the Boer War, who said, "It's always exhilarating to be shot at with no effect." I'm going to address some of that, but Judge, you asked Your Honor, you asked a question about the friends, the different friends. He actually had two friends there. On clerk's record, page 177, which is attached as summary judgment, it references a different friend named Nina, who saw him being expelled roughly from the bar. She's the one who went to the bouncers, and they said, "No, he's leaving, you stay." But that happened while his designated driver friend, Rick Carrillo, was in the restroom. So I just wanted to clarify that for the benefit of the court. What we're saying in this case, as far as the proximate cause argument, is that the only reasonable inferences that the jury could draw is that intoxication played a factor in what happened in the parking lot. And he, when asked by the trial court to brief the issue of causation, he relied on a case, I think it was called Stump case, where somebody, again, left the bar, I think it was at midnight or so, and was found way, miles away at the bottom of a bridge at 7 a.m. or something like that. And in that case, I think there would be a decent argument that there could be equal inferences about what happened. Was it a result of intoxication, or did somebody run that person off the road? It's more susceptible to equal inferences, such that circumstantial evidence, which every trial court instructs the jury that you can rely on circumstantial evidence, wouldn't be as effective. So
you've made it clear at the beginning of your pleading that it you consider it to be an assault, and you reasonably do that because the doctor says that this is the type of injury that would result from an assault as opposed to a fall. Okay, understand that. But there are three different types of assaults that are potentially here. One is the rough handling by the off-duty officers. Okay, two would be from a third party on the premises. And three is not even really an assault. It's just falling down or hitting something or something of that nature. So if the security issue is, under the Purple Goat case, covered underneath is excluded because of the Purple Goat case, okay, and security's covered under the Dram Shop Act, okay, then you get to premises with regard to the third party. You don't even know there was a third party, but even if there was a third party, you walk into Timberwalk in terms of did the bar know that the parking lot, somebody could get assaulted type of thing. So another case y'all might look at is Lincoln Property versus DeShazo, which I had some small, I'm still in therapy over many, many years after the fact, but anyway. All righty.
I have cases like that in my life too, Your Honor, but if I can just briefly say that because of the temporal and geographic proximity, he never left the premises, and this did happen moments. I think the affidavit of Mr. Creo makes it clear that this is just moments after he's thrown out that they find him face down with a bloody eye in the parking lot. I think a jury is allowed to draw reasonable inferences from the evidence, and I can understand how a court might say, well, you can't do that when it happened so far away and so many hours later, and we really don't know what happened, but obviously it was his intoxication. I mean, I think I can
the record deal. Does the record reflect he was walked out?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So the officers left the interior and went out into the parking lot with him.
Yeah, I don't know exactly if they went out into the exterior.
No, I'm not talking about how far.
Yes.
But they left the front door, they left the tavern interior.
He's going, you're staying, yes.
And they were observed holding him or touching him in some way to make sure that he left the interior premises.
Shoving him, roughly, is what okay. The evidence says, yes. And as the court knows, there can be more than one proximate cause. And so, you know, the first part of his argument was, this is intoxication. So, you know, all these other common law remedies, those aren't available because of the exclusive remedy provision. But then he turns around and says, well, there's no evidence of intoxication because it can be something else. That's having your cake and wanting to eat it too in the most promiscuous of ways. intoxication is going to be a proximate cause of whatever happened in the parking lot, even if he's the victim of crime. Well, I mean, he's going to be targeted for crime if he can't even stand up or fend for himself. If he was punched, he probably would have been able to duck that punch if he weren't intoxicated. Or, I mean, who knows? But I think myself, what the jury is going to conclude is that he was so drunk that he probably fell. Maybe he was shoved down and probably hit his eye that way. But you're right, the doctor did say that it's consistent with assault, and so we know that he was roughly thrown out of the bar by an aggressive bouncer, and so that's why we set it the way it is. But I think it should be up to the jury to decide, you know, based on after they hear all the evidence. And I think that concludes what I have to say. So thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
the oral argument has been very helpful, and with that, your case is submitted. You're excused to go on about your day. Thank you.
All right.